So far, you know, I've been teaching some of the hindrances of meditation and the power of mindfulness and the right attitude towards meditation, which I've been focusing on during this retreat, making peace, being kind, being gentle, waiting in the moment rather than waiting in the future. What happens is that if one practices in this way, the mind does become still. And I did mention earlier about the landmarks on the journey into stillness. And I want to start talking about the more further landmarks, especially the nimittas and the jhanas. Always during the retreat I like to indulge myself and just talk about these high states of meditation. But it's not just because I inspire myself by talking about these deeper stages of Dhamma, but also people to attain these stages. And it's important that people know what they are and what's happening with the mind and why it's happening and how it all fits in to the general scheme of Dhamma. Because when they understand how it all fits in, it means that they can understand, just as I said yesterday, when they know the destination, they know the path, they can understand just if they're going in the correct direction or not. So sometimes when we are practicing, it's difficult to know whether we are going in the correct direction or not. Some time ago I gave a simile. When I was a young man, I liked to spend a lot of my vacations from university up in Scotland alone, camping in youth hostels, finding solitude in the mountains, and it's a very beautiful part of the world in the north of Scotland. And I remember one day spending overnight in a youth hostel, and the warden invited me to go walk up a couple of the mountains. And so, you know, he's supposed to have known the area, he was a local. So we went up to this mountain, got to the top and enjoyed the beautiful view. It was a nice sunny summer day, just a few clouds in the sky. It was a beautiful day. So we sat on the top of that mountain, enjoyed the view. He decided he wanted to go back to do some work in the hostel, and I decided I'd go up another mountain. It was only, you know, maybe a couple of kilometres away. So it's not that long a walk. So I climbed up the other mountain, and that time, only about half an hour, the whole weather system changed. Clouds came in, and I was on the top of the mountain, or close to the top, and the cloud descended. And when the cloud descends, when you're in the mist, you've got no landmarks, you don't know where you're going. And I got completely lost. It can be very dangerous to get lost in the mountains in the mist, and sometimes people wander around for days. But I knew my direction. I had a sense of direction. I knew I'd come from that direction, and that's the way back down. So I walked in the direction which I thought was going to take me back to the hostel. And I was very mindful. It was a very good job, because as I was walking, I saw just, no, actually not that far, maybe a foot, 2 foot in front of me, this vertical cliff going down. Because I could actually see below. The mist had cleared down below, and I could see the light there. If I hadn't been mindful, I'd have just one, two more steps and fallen over that cliff and I wouldn't be here. It was very dangerous. And later on, when I saw the map, I'd gone 180 degrees in the opposite direction to the direction I thought I was going in. It just showed me that when you're in the mist, you think you're going in the right direction, but you can be totally deluded. In delusion, we think we're aiming for nirvana, we think we're aiming for stillness, but we can go in completely opposite direction. So I had to try something else. How to get down from this mountain? Because it was going to be dangerous. Those weather systems can last for days, and I could have been stuck up there. So the insight came, as long as you are going down, you must eventually end up at the bottom. So that's what I did. I looked for the gradient which always was going down. And eventually, you know, you found a little stream. And great, because streams never go uphill, they always go down. And so I followed the stream. And soon, in, you know, maybe only half an hour, you got below the mist. And then I could actually understand my surroundings and understanding how to get back to the hostel. But it was the understanding that as long as you're going down, you must eventually reach the bottom. And that gave me this simile about in meditation. As long as you're getting a little bit more peaceful, then you're going to end up in jhanas. That's the path. Even though you can't see sort of the jhanas in the great distance, because you're still in the mist, as long as you're going into more states of stillness, more states of peace. If you're going in that direction, you have to eventually get to those deeper states of stillness. In the same way that when you're always going down, you must reach the bottom. So that gives you a feel for what meditation is and what you should be doing. When you know that stillness is the goal, you know that you may be way distant from absolute stillness, but at least you know you're getting more still, and then more still, and then more still, and eventually you must end up at the jhanas. So that's why we have these landmarks, and I've gone over many of those landmarks before. When you start to make peace, be kind, be gentle, you do get in the present moment. Time has no more meaning for you, because that's one of the first things you let go of. When you become still, time disappears. And of course, for many people, that's such a weird experience, to be in this timeless realm where sometimes I have to just remind myself, even this retreat, whether it's Monday, Thursday, I think it's Friday, but a couple of days ago I had to ask somebody and I just couldn't remember what day it was. And that's actually quite strange. In fact, it's so strange. I remember once, first year here in Perth, then there was a man who had an epileptic fit in our centre. So I called the ambulance, and the people came, and he had reasonably recovered from his epileptic seizure, but nevertheless, the ambulance was there, and they started interviewing him. And the first thing they asked him is, "What day is it?" And that rang alarm bells for me, because even I didn't know what day it was. And if they'd have asked me that question, they'd have taken me in the ambulance as well. Because, you know what, any ambulance driver or psychiatric nurse or whatever, that's the first question they ask you. You know, what's your name and what day is it and where do you live? And if you can't answer the right day, they think you're absolutely crazy and mad. That's how unusual it is not to know the day of the week. But this is, again, no exaggeration. In Thailand, as a young monk, it wasn't I didn't know the day of the week. I didn't know that at all. And I didn't know the month of the year. And actually, no exaggeration, I forgot what year it was. And so I remember some people come and I had to actually ask them, "What's the year this year?" So it's becoming like a timeless zone. You've let go of that. And it's amazing just how much peace and how much freedom you feel when you're not involved in this thing we call the passage of time. When days and weeks, hours, minutes and seconds have no more meaning for you. You're just here meditating. You're enjoying this moment. You're at peace in this moment. And then time just flows without you trying to rush it along. Or without you lingering on things which have already passed. It's one of the first levels or landmarks of letting go. Timelessness. You're letting go of time. And many of you experience that. And then you let go of this commentary to go into a silent mind. And again, many of you experience that as well. Even if you may be just walking outside in a beautiful afternoon where it's nice and warm and the birds are singing and there's a slight breeze. And it's so delightful, you can't think. There's just too much interesting stuff going on. You're getting still and silent. And that degree of stillness we call the silent mind when there's no inner commentary going on. That is very, very delightful. You realize you're going in the correct direction. You're going down from the noisy, complicated world into states of stillness. And the more you make peace and be kind, be gentle, these things happen naturally. And as I mentioned, I think yesterday or the day before, then whether you want to watch the breath or you don't want to watch the breath appears in your mind. And the reason why it appears is because, as I said, the mind only notices things which are changing. And when you're sitting still, and there's nothing going on elsewhere in the body, then that's the last of the physical feelings which are actually moving. Something's happening there. So the mind has got nothing else to watch because everything else is still and comfortable. So the only other thing which is moving is the breath. And that's why you notice it. So the breath is actually a stage of stillness. It's a landmark. You don't really have to go and choose to watch it. It will come to you because that's the nature. When things start to disappear, only the things which move are what's left. So you just go watching the breath. And of course, as you become more and more still, the breath becomes more and more evident to you. You become more clear. And as you become more and more still, the mindfulness increases, not just so you can see more, it becomes more beautiful and delightful. And many of you experience that in meditation, just when the breath becomes just so delightful. And that's the happy stages of meditation, when you see people meditating here and they start smiling and they're enjoying it and they want to sit for longer and they don't think the meditation is a chore, but the meditation is a wonderful thing they love doing because of the delight in a still mind which is energized. That's why I introduce the stage of the delightful breath or the beautiful breath. I use the word beautiful breath at first because that's the word which meant a lot to me, because it was just so beautiful, just this breath when it got still. But for other people, say that's a bit too visual, so we call it the delightful breath. And I think that's a more accurate term, to call it the delightful breath, because it gives you so much happiness and delight just to watch this breath. Now that's not something you cultivate, it's not something you make happen. This is when you're getting more and more still, more and more peaceful, this is just what occurs. In the Anapanasati Sutta, that became the fifth and sixth stages of the 16 steps. Breathing in and out, the meditator develops piti. Breathing in and out, the meditator develops sukha. This sort of happiness and bliss, which comes with meditation. It's supposed to happen. This is what is par for the course. And so if any teacher comes along and tells you, be afraid of that delighted meditation because you'll get attached to it, please just tell that monk that they don't understand, or that nun, or that teacher, they haven't read the Anapanasati Sutta. They haven't realized that the happiness and bliss is part of the practice. It's to be expected. It's just what happens. And that happiness and bliss which comes with the delightful breath is just the happiness and bliss which is based on stillness, based on letting go. You can't be attached to letting go. It's what we call the oxymoron, like military intelligence, as they say, or honest politician. Oxymoron, two words put together which have opposite meanings. So, you can't be attached to letting go. You're either letting go or you're being attached. You can't do two at the same time. And you can't, therefore, be attached to that bliss and happiness which comes from letting go. It's there for you. Enjoy it. Make peace with it. Let it happen. You deserve it. I don't know why people are afraid of happiness. Maybe it's because of that Christian Protestant idea that the more pain, the more gain. If you enjoy it, it must be sinful. And of course, that's not part of the Buddhist path. There's no peace, no gain. No happiness. No release. Or what you could say, no happiness, no samadhi. Because that's what the Buddha said. Sukhino jitang samadhiyati. Only from happiness that the mind becomes still. And this is what happens. The mind becomes happy just watching this beautiful breath, this delightful breath. And the breath becomes more calm, more still. This thing which the mind can notice because it's moving becomes calmer and calmer and calmer because you're delighted. You don't have to do anything. When there's delight in the mind, it satisfies the mind. And because of satisfaction and contentment, you don't do anything. When the mind's dissatisfied and discontent, that makes your mind move and you start thinking and doing business, trying to find a way to make your mind happier. When the mind is content, it generates this sense of not having to do anything at all, which is a cause for stillness. So that delightful breath makes you even more still until the breath disappears. It's not moving anymore. Because it doesn't move, therefore it disappears. Now to be noticed that this is the experience when you're watching the breath. It is true at first you can notice the in-breath and the out-breath. And it's true as your awareness grows through stillness, you can see the beginning of an in-breath, see the middle, see the end of an in-breath, see the gaps between the breaths, We see so much more detail about the breath. But as the mindfulness and the stillness increases, you find the breath becomes a smooth passage. And there comes a stage, and many of you know this, where it's just breath happening. And that perception that it's in or it's out has vanished, it's disappeared. You don't notice if it's in or out. And I gave a simile on the first night of the simile of the soul from Buddhaghosa, that when you first saw in a piece of wood, you can see the end of the saw, the handle of the saw, you can see the piece of wood, the whole of it. But as you focus in, the only important point is the area where the saw is touching the wood. And after a few seconds, if you notice when you're sawing a piece of wood, you could only see three or four sawtooth blades, so saw teeth. You can only see just maybe a centimetre of wood, just the part which is being cut. And you don't know whether those saw teeth are the beginning of the blade, the middle of the blade, or the end of the blade, because it's all the same. The perception of beginning or end has disappeared. All you know is a sawtooth touching a piece of wood, and that's all. So as you focus in with stillness, many perceptions disappear. And with the breath, the perception of in or out, beginning or end disappears. When you get to the stage, it's a delightful feeling of breath, and you don't know if it's the middle or the beginning or the end of a breath. You don't know whether it's in or out. It all feels the same. Just like you don't know whether it's Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Monday, Tuesday, because all the days are the same. And those perceptions fade away. So all you've got is a feeling of the breath. Now this is an important experience, because when the perceptions of in or out, which signify to you change, whenever there's no beginning, middle or end, which also signifies movement, then it's just breath. And because the breath is experienced as the same, moment to moment to moment, only then can it disappear. Remember, only when things are unchanging can they vanish from your mind. And this is what happens. The breath disappears. It's not there anymore. When the breath disappears, please never think that you're not breathing. You are breathing. It's just your awareness is so refined, it's gone way beyond the breath. And at such time, because the rest of the body should be still, you should be unaware of any physical feeling in the body. No feeling in the head, the arms, the legs. You don't notice this happening. It's just afterwards you realize you weren't aware of anything to do with the body. These were stages which I really enjoyed as a relief from the suffering of things like mosquitoes in Thailand. The only way you could escape from the irritating mosquitoes was to go into such states of stillness. So if the mosquitoes were biting your arm, you couldn't feel your arm. If they were crawling on your head, you couldn't feel them, because you need to let go of your body. This is an important stage of meditation. You're getting so still, the body has disappeared. And it's a great sense of freedom, and a great sense of joy. The happiness and blisses of each stage are directly related to the fact that the body is suffering and the body is now being taken away. It's not there for you anymore. You feel so free and so happy and peaceful. Exactly the same just after you die. After you die, when this body has been left behind, you feel just so free and peaceful. It's a common experience for people who have near-death experiences, who die temporarily and come back into their body and tell the tale. And it's also common for people who really do die. But after the death, the process of death may be painful and troublesome, but as soon as the body disappears, what a relief. The body is like a big backpack which you have tied to your back, full of heavy rocks. And you've been carrying it around for so long, ever since you were born, you got used to the weight. And then one day somebody takes that backpack off for you and you feel light, like you can dance. A big heavy burden has been taken away. And that's actually what happens when you die. The burden of this big, heavy, demanding body has been taken away and you feel so free. And that's also what you feel in that state of meditation, the sense of freedom from the body. And that is such a delight. And that delight energizes your mind even more. And when that mind gets energized, that's the only thing left to see. You see your mind. The Buddha said there were six senses: seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, and mind. And I don't know why it is, because most of Western philosophy, I think it was Pythagoras who said this. He said all our philosophy came from the Indians, which was the Buddhists. The Buddhists were in Greece before sort of the great philosophers. I think just the Buddha passed away just a few years before the birth of Socrates. So Buddhism was there, it was around. And it was the Indians who said that, for example, Alexander the Great, he invaded India because he knew about it. The Indians were already there. Remember, there's one fascinating piece of history. I always wanted to investigate this more fully. So there was an Indian monk, as recorded in the by the ancient Greek philosophers, an Indian monk who went into the market in Athens and immolated himself and caused a sensation. Not with a flame, but just what they say in traditional Buddhism, entered the fire element. And that was a traditional way that enlightened monks would die. That's how Ananda passed away. The story of Ananda was that after the Buddha died, he lived quite a few more years. And because he was the most famous of all the disciples by this time, everybody was waiting for him to die to get his relics. Because relics were a big business by that time in India. You know, it's supposed to bring you good fortune and maybe bring you many pilgrims. And so that there were two kingdoms or two clans were following him, trying to get him to die on their territory so that they could get his ashes. You know, a similar thing happened to St. Francis of Assisi, that people were trying to get him to come to their city because they knew that such a famous saint, if he died in their town, they would get so many pilgrims, it would be good for business. That's what happens. So you've got to be very careful with this relic business. Even, I've got to be careful these days, because a few months ago I went to my dentist and I had a wisdom tooth which was cracked. And so he removed it. And I didn't think twice about it. He said, "Oh, can I keep this?" I said, "Yeah, sure." Now I wondered if I did the right thing. I think he's going to put it on eBay to auction it. You've got to be careful with this relic business. So, the Ananda was concerned about sort of keeping the peace. And so what he did, he walked to the boundary between these two kingdoms, or these two little republics, which was a river. And he levitated into the middle of the river, and right dead bang in the center of the river, he entered the fire element, immolated his old body, and because his determination before he passed into Parinibbana, he determined that his ashes would fall in two equal parts on either side of the river, so that people wouldn't go to war. And that was the myth. Another monk, Dabba Malaputta, also is recorded to have died in the same way, rising up into the air, entering the fire element and disappearing that way. It seemed to be a common way which holy monks passed away without needing to have a cremation. They just did it themselves. And this monk in Athens seemed to have done the same, and is recorded by the Greeks causing a sensation. It must have been something really weird and psychic that they saw this. But anyway, the point was that the Buddhists were in Athens and they were influencing everything. And all these ancient philosophers, the Greek philosophers, Socrates, Heraclitus, Pythagoras, they all believed in rebirth. And even that woman, Heraclitus, he's on record of remembering a past life as a fish. He wasn't just human to human like the Theosophists. It was animal to human, human to animal, deva realms. So it's part of Greek philosophy. But the Aristotle was the fellow who said, yeah, there are six senses. We have the five external senses of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching. And we have the sixth sense, which is the mind. And he was the first person who called that the common sense. Because the mind can see everything your eyes can see, it can hear, it can smell, taste, it can feel physical feelings as well. So it's common to all the other senses, just like the Buddha said. So even the Greeks had six senses. And I sometimes wonder about how we lost that in the history of Western world. How in 2,000 years, and 2,300 or 400 years, the Western world lost its mind and lost its common sense. And why we keep thinking it's only five senses, only five senses, five senses. It's weird. But anyway, that when those five senses stop, and then you get to the realm of the mind, you are with the sixth sense because everything else has passed away. And usually the way that mind appears to you, when all the five senses have stopped, the way that mind appears to you is this beautiful light we call the nimitta. That's just the common way. It is not a light. You aren't seeing with your eyes. Your eyes are closed. But we're seeing an experience which is not being seen with our five senses. And it's seen with the sixth sense. It's a pure mental experience. And we have a hard time understanding what we're experiencing. Which is why that sometimes when people first see nimittas, they get totally confused. They don't know what the heck this is. And the reason is because you're going to new territory that you've hardly ever been there before. Sometimes you have, but very infrequently. And what our perception, how our mind works, it looks in the database of past experiences. And looks at this experience. This experience now, what is it closest to? What is it near to? And the nearest experience which people can get from their past, which is closest to the experience of this pure mind, is a light. Which is why that people see it as a light. And it does not matter what colour it is. Sometimes it's just the colour you expect. If I told everybody that the best nimitta was a pink nimitta, then that's the nimitta you would see. It's not pink. It's not purple. We add these colours onto that nimitta. This is just how perception works. This is what we add on to our experiences. So it is the mind, and it doesn't matter at all what colour it is. But when you really get into these nimittas, just allow the mind to be, and let the five senses disappear, and keep the energy flowing into the mind. Whatever colour it is, it usually is an unworldly colour. By which it is blue, but it's just deeper than any blue you can see in the real world. It is white, but it's radiant. It's more pure white than you've ever seen before. You know, you can wash your clothes and have brilliant white, but this is more white than white. Or more green than green. This is common feature of nimittas. It's a rich colour, deeper colour. And you give it that name because that's the closest you can get from your memory bank, which is the cause of perceptions. We perceive according to our past experiences. And the most important thing of the nimitta, there's two important things, is whether that nimitta is very bright and powerful, and whether it's still. And these are important things to understand with nimittas. It doesn't matter the colour, it doesn't matter the size, it doesn't matter whether it's a ball or a star or a square or whatever it is. It doesn't matter. What's really important is number one, it's stillness, and number two, it's brilliance. And those are the things which you will notice are landmarks on the path to even deeper stillness. To be still, if that nimitta is a reflection of your own mind, to make that nimitta still, what should you do? If you understand that it only moves because you move, it's a reflection of you. It only wobbles if you wobble. The simile which I got, which explains it almost perfectly, is a simile of you getting up in the morning, going to the bathroom and looking in the mirror. And there you see an image of yourself in the mirror. And the image is moving backwards and forwards, backwards and forwards. And so when the image is moving backwards and forwards, you try and hold the mirror straight. It's nothing to do with the mirror. It's not the mirror's fault. It's the one who's looking is moving. In this simile, you have a nimitta and it's moving backwards and forwards. You try and hold the nimitta still. And of course, that's just like holding the mirror still. You're holding the wrong thing. Instead of holding the mirror still, the one who's watching, you should be still. Stop moving, stop doing things. And then the image in the mirror stabilizes. It's the same in when you have a nimitta. You, the person experiencing this, has to be still. And then the nimitta will be still. You, the experiencer, do something, and your nimitta will do something. It will move. You become unstable. So you can see that with the nimitta stage, you have to be even more still. You can't move at all. And the standard simile, the best simile, came from Ajahn Chah, is the simile of the still forest pool. It's a great metaphor. In the time of the forest monks, when there was a forest to go to, there's hardly any forest left now, except on the borders, which were a bit dangerous. In the time of the great forest, the monks would wander from place to place. And it was the obvious tradition to find a body of water late in the afternoon or evening. A lake, a stream, at least a well. And Ajahn Chah recounted many of his experiences when he was wandering through the forest and jungles. He would often find a lake in the forest, the still forest pool. And he would bathe in that water, having walked all day. He would maybe wash a robe and fill his water bottle using the filter which every monk had to carry. And having filled his water bottle, bathed and washed, he would set up his mosquito net umbrella a few meters away from the lake's edge, maybe 20 meters, far enough away so that the animals who would later come to drink would not disturb him, and he wouldn't disturb them. Of course, most evenings you just sit with your eyes closed and meditate. He said sometimes he would keep his eyes open at twilight to watch all the animals come out and drink and play by the water's edge. In the days before National Geographic Channel, before David Attenborough, that was the only way you could see wildlife, by going out and watching them. But he said to be able to see them he had to sit perfectly still, because the animals were so afraid of human beings, because the human beings, the only ones they knew were the hunters who would kill them. So the animals were conditioned to be so afraid of humans. And so if they realized there was a human being there, even though it was a peaceful monk, still they would be afraid. So Ajahn Chah had to sit perfectly still. And when he sat perfectly still, then the animals would not notice he was there. They would just play, drink, frolic by the water's edge. It was delightful, he said, to watch these animals. I remember often doing the same. One of my abiding memories of being in a remote monastery in the north of Thailand and putting a bowl of water out for the birds every evening. And I would spy on them through a knot hole in the wood of my hut. And I would watch them. It was so delightful that these were wild birds. And every evening they would queue up for their water. There'd be a line of them. I don't know how they'd organise this and how they worked it out. There'd be a line of birds. First come would be in the front, the latecomers would stand behind the last one who came. And patiently they wait their turn to actually get in the water. You've seen the birds in the water. They go in there, they drink a bit, and they splash around to wash their wings, and then they fly off, and the next one would come and use the water. But every now and again, there would be one bird come in who would jump the queue and try and get in there first. And all the other birds would jump on it and peck it and chase it away. It was delightful, actually, to see these little animals in the wild, you know, acting like proto-human beings. You know, sometimes when you notice animals in the wild, you realize that there's not that much difference between animals and human beings. If there's any difference at all. But anyway, I was delighted in those memories, seeing these animals in the wild and then realizing, not realizing you're watching. So it's delightful to do that. But anyway, Ajahn Chah kept on by saying that sometimes he would be so still, sitting a few meters from the water's edge, not moving a muscle, not even blinking. And then he said, the amazing animals would come out. These rare jungle beings, who even he never knew existed. His parents and teachers had never told him about such beautiful and wonderful beings who lived in the jungle, because they were so shy. If they thought a human being was around, they would never come close. He said they were beautiful and delightful, but so rare. And if he moved at all, if he said, wow, or if he got scared, they would know that someone was there looking at them. And they would run back into the forest and not come out again for days. And he used that experience from his life to describe the nimittas, these beautiful experiences which only a few people witness. They only come out when you're absolutely still, sitting by the still forest pool, which is your mind, sitting there, not doing anything, waiting. At the right time, these beings will come out, these beautiful nimittas. But if you say, wow, a nimitta, I've got to tell Ajahn Brahm. There they run away, they don't come out again for days. Or if you get afraid, they know you're watching, and again they disappear and don't come out again for weeks. Which is why it's a test of your stillness. The ability to watch without doing anything at all. That's why these stages of meditation is landmarks on the journey. Every landmark you have to pass a deeper and higher test. You have to be more skilled in letting go and being still and not reacting. And this is one of the last tests, to see a nimitta without reacting to it. If you react to it with fear or with excitement, the two biggest upakalesas, the Buddha called, then that nimitta runs away. So nimittas come up, it's a training for deeper samadhi. How can you be with that beautiful light and stay with it without interfering with it? After a while you get used to this, you've got the right instructions, just make peace, be kind, be gentle, don't do anything. This is a deeper stage of stillness, so stillness is the goal, stillness is the path. So don't do anything. You've got a nimitta. Enjoy it. Instead of saying, what should I do next? If ever that word comes up, next, you should say, stupid, I've lost the present moment. It's nothing to do with what you're doing next, it's what you're doing now. And what you're doing now is already here, you can't do anything about it, so shut up and enjoy it. So this is what we do, we just learn. Now from this experience, you blow it many times, you really stuff up several times before you get the hang of just being with the nimitta and realizing all you have to do is nothing. Just be there and let it play in front of your mind. And as it plays in front of your mind, it gets still. As it gets still, as I said earlier, from stillness the energy goes into the mind, into the knowing mind. That's what you've got in front of you. That nimitta gets brighter and brighter and brighter. And with it, just get more and more bliss, but not the bliss which disturbs and agitates you. Not the bliss which makes you shout up and say, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Not that type of exciting happiness. It's this beautiful, subtle, intense, but still pleasure. And when that really builds up, as that energy is enough and the stillness is enough, then you go to the next landmark of stillness. That nimitta is so still, so brilliant, that disappears. And all you're left is with the brilliance, with the joy, with the bliss. It's hard to find similes for these stages, but there is a simile which I got from English literature. And I'm not sure if this is what the author meant, but it's just a beautiful simile for what happens next. And it's a simile of Alice in Wonderland. It could be that Through the Looking Glass, I forget which book, the simile of the Cheshire Cat, where Alice sees a cat on a branch of a tree. And it's a Cheshire Cat, which is a cat which is supposed to be always smiling. And as he sees his cat, the cat suddenly vanishes and then reappears. And then vanishes and reappears. And Alice complains to the cat. He said, "It's given me a headache the way you come and go so quickly." "Oh, does it?" said the compassionate cat. "Okay, I'll vanish slowly for you." And then the cat started vanishing slowly. First its tail disappeared. And then its legs disappeared. And then its body disappeared, so it was just the head. Then its ears vanished, all very slowly. Then its whiskers vanished. And then its head vanished, leaving only a smile. And Alice remarked, I think this is verbatim, Alice remarked, "This is strange. I've often seen a cat without a smile, but I've never seen a smile without a cat." And how can that be? A smile without a head to do the smiling. That's perfect simile for what happens in the jhanas. The smile, the bliss is left with nothing to do the smiling. Everything else has disappeared. Disembodied bliss. Now of course those are weird experiences. They're weird experiences because you're going to places which you've never been to before, or places which you've been to but so long ago you can't remember. But the nice thing about the jhana is they are so still and they're so pleasurable. So what? Who needs to understand them? You just enjoy. Biggest bliss of your life. And still bliss, a different flavour of bliss than you're used to. And so stable. The reason why these jhanas last a long time is because what you've let go of is your controller, your will. It is craving which actually keeps time running. Will creates time. When craving and will disappear, there's nothing to move you. There's nothing to move the world into time. Everything stops and is perfectly still. Which is why in those jhana stages you spend a long time there, perfectly alert, but no perception of the passage of time. Time passes by you, but never through you, never into you. It's apart from you, you're timeless. So you come out afterwards, you haven't got a clue how many minutes, hours, days have gone past. You don't care because you're blissed out. And it's only when you come out afterwards, when the mind starts to move again, that you start to figure out, wow, that was just an amazing experience. It is true, as people say, that you cannot get any insight or wisdom within a jhana. It's too still or stable. But it is the memory of that jhana, the experience of it, which you look back upon afterwards, that is pregnant with insights. It's just like a tree with so many low-hanging fruit, you just pick them all off. It's afterwards you look back upon that state. What was that? Why was that? And because the mind is being empowered, not only can you remember that clearly, you can also investigate it deeply. You can remember it clearly because these are powerful states of mind. And again, trying to find a simile is hard. And the closest simile would be painful trauma. If you've had a car accident, or if you've had sort of any other tragedy, sometimes people call it trauma. And you have flashbacks every time. Somebody was saying in one of the interviews about a Canadian researcher who was finding some Tibetan monks, whenever they passed the toilets and smelt urine, they remembered the times they were forced to drink urine in prison as a punishment. And we remarked, that's not a punishment, I drank my own urine for several years in Thailand, it's supposed to be good for you. And many of the other monks have, that's not a punishment, actually after a while it's quite tasty. Try it one day. It's only urine, it's only four elements, so what? When you've eaten frog on rice and rotten fish, urine can actually be quite delicious compared to the other things I used to eat. But anyway, whatever is really painful for you or intense is branded into your memory. You can't get it out again. Now usually we use those memories as, or those traumas, or those types of branded memories, only to refer to the very painful and negative and frightening experiences of our life. But the same power of imprinting happens to the very positive, powerful, blissful moments in our life. So if you've had a jhana, it's like a trauma in the sense it's indelibly imprinted into your mind. And it's just so easy for you to go and pick up and investigate. You can remember it just so easy because it's a powerful, intense experience. It's called in Pali, Pachawekana Jhana. It's called the insight which comes from reviewing, or reviewing knowledge. After you've attained one of those deep states, you look back. It's hard not to. Personally, I can't imagine how anybody could have an intense experience like that and not look back upon it. Wow, that was something. And ask the next question, why? What was that? And the job of the teacher, the job of the Buddha, is actually to give you some framework to understand what was happening. And what was happening was a huge bliss. That was the object of your mind. That's what you were experiencing. Just the way that you may be just looking at me now, or in breath meditation, you're aware of the breath, or you may be aware of a thought. In a jhana, you're aware of bliss. But a bliss which is powerful and unchanging. A very, very stable experience. It's one of the weirdest parts of it. The things don't move in these states. There is what I call the wobble in the first jhana, but for the second jhana onwards is absolute stillness. Weird to notice. Well, you can't move. Everything is like frozen, like ice, like diamond. Bliss, unmoving. Inside, not able to feel the body. Afterwards, that's one of the questions we ask people. You know, could you hear anything? Could you feel the aches and pains in the body? Did you hear the bell when we rang it, when everybody went out? And the answer, if it's a jhana, was no. There's lovely stories about this. One of the nice stories of this little novice monk. This little novice monk in Ajahn Chah's monastery, who, like everybody, had to listen to the sermons of Ajahn Chah. And those of you who haven't heard me say this before, I was a disciple of Ajahn Chah for 9 years. I lived with him, not just read his book, but studied and was with him. And people think that Ajahn Chah was just a great, inspiring teacher, because the books which you have these days are just skimmed from all his talks, the best and most profound sayings. But most of what he said, and I say this with the greatest respect for my teacher, most of what he said was waffle and rubbish. And you sit there for hour and after hour, but it was worth it, because every now and again he'd throw out this amazing insight, and it was worth it waiting for those little bits of insight. Now you have all the best insights put in the books, and all the waffle, the hours which I had to sit waiting for these things, you don't have to do that anymore. It's all been filtered for you. But some of the talks would go on for hours, sometimes all night, starting at sort of 9 o'clock, and you wouldn't finish till 4 or 5 in the morning. And you had to sit there. You couldn't go out and go to the toilet. You just had to sit there and sit there and sit there. And it was all right for someone like me, because I was a monk. I was a strong guy, a tough guy. But you know, in these monasteries, sometimes I have these little novices, 10, 11, 12 years of age. And they go there because, you know, either they have no family or their parents are beating them, and it's a refuge from abuse or from neglect. So I had one of these 11 or 12 year novices, was having to endure another 5 or 6 hour sermon from Ajahn Chah. And after a while, when it hadn't finished after a couple of hours, and he told us this, he kept on thinking, when is Ajahn Chah going to stop? When is Ajahn Chah going to stop? When is he going to stop? When is he going to stop? And this became like an obsessive thought in this little novice's mind. It was like his mind getting into a rut. When is he going to stop? When is he going to get stopped? And at some point, he had a switch of mind, a little insight. After an hour or two of thinking, when is Ajahn Chah going to stop? He thought, when am I going to stop? And he stopped. And when he opened his eyes, it was light. All the monks had gone out of the hall a long time ago. He hadn't heard the talk stop. He hadn't heard the bell ring and doing the Arahang Sama Sambuddho. He got into his first deep meditation. He stopped. And that's a wonderful little story about how the novice got his first experience of jhanas and what it was like. He couldn't hear anything. He stopped. That's why I've mentioned that word. It's a powerful word. Stop and become still. So when that happens, now you can't hear anything. You can't feel the body. That's one of the standard tests to know whether it's a real jhana or not. So you're in this beautiful deep state inside. And afterwards, when you come out, you understand what it was. These little things you ask, could you hear anything? Could you move the body? Could you think? Could you have a conception in the mind about this is jhana? If you have a thought in the mind, is this jhana? It's not. You can't have such thoughts in there, you're too still. That's another sort of standard test. The thought is stopped. There's a subverbal movement of the mind in the first jhana. The second jhana is even, no, well, that's gone. You just can't move enough to think. So when those things happen, you know that was one of these jhanas which the monks talk about. You know what it was. Now, investigate it. It's a clear memory. You can just pick it up so easily. What was it like? What was there? What was missing? One of the questions I encourage you to ask is, what was missing? Not what was there, not what you're experiencing, but what you weren't experiencing. Because this ties in with the simile of the tadpole. The tadpole has gone onto dry land for the first time. It's what was missing is where you get your deep insights from. In those jhanas, what's gone? What's vanished? And there you find your body has vanished. With it the 5 senses. And how does it feel? Blissful. And you should have enough intelligence to get the connection. It's blissful because this body is dukkha. It's not attachment to the body which is dukkha. The body is dukkha. It is a bundle of suffering. And that bundle of suffering has now vanished. How Ajahn Chah described it, he You described it as this boy who was born with a rope tied around his neck, so tightly he could hardly breathe. But he survived. He managed to embrace his rope around his neck. He got used to it. He didn't notice it anymore. And then one day, someone cut that rope and freed it. I can breathe! He never realized such a thing was possible. There was such freedom and such bliss when that rope was cut off. That's Ajahn Chah's simile of what a jhana is like. Something which has been tying you and oppressing you ever since you can remember has now been cut and released. You've let go of your body. Oh, what bliss. At the very least, if you understand that and keep investigating that point after a jhana, you'll never be attached to your body again when you realize how much of a pain it is. You get what we call nibbida towards this body, this sense of revulsion towards it, not in a negative state. Oh, this is a pain, this is a burden. I know something much better than this. Also, you'll never be afraid of death. What is death? Just getting rid of this massive suffering called a body. You're not afraid of death anymore. Most of you say, bring it on, like Mr. Bush said. So you won't be afraid of death, because you know what the body is. Why are people afraid of death? To me, it's one of the most ridiculous, stupid things. People are afraid of dying, and they get so sad when somebody dies. I am never sad at a funeral, except when I hear how that person has wasted their life. Dying is not a cause of sadness. Living can be, if you don't live well. So that's why I only get sad at a funeral if I found a person who's completely wasted their life and wasted their time. What a waste of a beautiful experience. So that's one thing, you're not afraid of death anymore. You're not so attached to this body. You know, you're not attached to whether you're beautiful or whether you're ugly. When I was young, or actually when I was a kid, I fell over and broke my front tooth, and it was a black tooth. And even when I was in Thailand, I had this black tooth in the middle of my tooth. And even though some people said, I would take you to the dentist and get it capped, I said, no, this is my protection. Protection against what? Protection against girls. They look at me and say, got black tooth, no, we don't want him. So for years and years, all my Thai disciples over there, they wouldn't take me to the dentist. Only when I got much older as a monk and much safer, so I got it capped. So it was actually great good karma. I had a black tooth. And so you're not worried about your body and what it looks like. And that's why that monks are sloppy. Really good monks are sloppy. They don't really care about whether they've shaved today or whether their robes are all over the place. You know, it's not a fashion parade when we sit up here. So this is what things happen. You get into deep meditation, you don't care about this body so much. And you know something else, you know what the body is, so you can let it go. So death is no problem for you anymore. But also you've got this mind in front of you, the mind and not the body anymore. It's not complicated anymore by a body, it's got the mind, real jitter. You can actually see what happens to it. Number one, the vexing which disappears. You have to get these experiences. This is why I say that people argue with me, but I can't see it. How you can become enlightened without getting into a jhana. I can't even see how you can become a stream winner without getting into a jhana. I just can't understand how that could happen. How you can understand non-self without the experience of at least a jhana. To see things disappear. How you can understand what water is without getting out of the lake. I just can't understand that. Now, it may be a limitation of my wisdom, but I'm just being honest with you. Will disappears in the second jhana, the doer. And that's really crazy. For the first time, you can't do anything. It's like half of you has vanished. The most important part of you has gone. The one who's in control. The one who decides what to do and how you're going to do it. The thing which you're cultivated and worried about for such a long time, really all the time probably. We have bills of human rights to guarantee your freedom of will. Freedom of will is something which is just so cherished by almost everybody, that to suggest the will can stop and you can still be there is just almost impossible to conceive. You go to that place where that's what it's like. That's one of the salient features of the second jhana and above, which when you come out afterwards you look, inspect the memory of that. Will had completely disappeared. Gone, vanished, not there. That's very obvious from there on, that you are not the one who chose to come here. You are not the one who meditates. All of this struggling and striving to watch the breath, to get peaceful, to be still, to be wise, is a complete waste of time. Have you been doing that such a long time? Why haven't you suffered? All the struggle and striving. This is not just a path because it works. This is a path because this is Dhamma. There is no one inside who's driving your bus. So why are you trying to drive it? Why are you playing around and imagining that you're in control? You ain't. And as soon as you realize that, the more happy you'll be. This is a realization. I'm not the one who drives my bus. There is no driver of my bus. It's just the process. Straight away that you've weakened craving. The source of suffering. The cause of rebirth. Craving. Will. Is fatally wounded. And after a while, it's only a time before you get out of the habit of struggling and craving and trying and manipulating and scheming and controlling yourself and others and your mind. You stop doing that for a change. And you've seen, at least, the word is not a self. And when you stop controlling things, you have much more peace in life. You can't control your family. You can't control your kids. You can't control the economy. It's obvious, all these amazing economists paid fortunes running the IMF and the World Bank and treasuries, and they still couldn't predict the credit crunch. I mean, what are these guys paid for? Shouldn't they have known that something like that was going to happen? Imagine that was a weatherman and they never saw the cyclone coming, even though it was just, you know, a few miles off the coast. They'd all get the sack. It's economists, but be fair to them. They don't know what's going on. Neither do you. You try and control the economy and it's beyond control. You try and control the weather, you just can't do it. You try and control your meditation. Impossible. Has the penny dropped yet? Stop trying to control the meditation. Stop trying to make this the best meditation retreat ever. Stop trying to get still. You're completely wasting your time. When you do that, then you get still. Then you get peaceful. Then the jhanas happen. Then everything is brilliant and you're enlightened. Meditation is easy when you disappear. So you say, I'm going to disappear. You can't disappear. You can't make yourself disappear. Get out of the way. Stop doing anything. It's such a hard thing to do, isn't it? It goes against the grain. But anyway, once you get the idea of it, sometimes you just fluke it. You fluke a jhana. I don't care how you get it. Fluke it, trick it, whatever. Because once you've got one, you get some information. You can see what's going on. And wow, yeah, now I understand. And once you get that, the meditation becomes easier afterwards if you really understand it. Because you understand there is no self in there. But then what really happens is the other freaky thing. Because remember, there's many jhanas. What happens next is something else disappears. Because the mind is still. Because nothing is moving. Even the mind stops. fades away. Just like the Cheshire Cat, even the smile starts to disappear. But it starts to disappear slowly. After the fourth jhana, absolute stillness, then space disappears. Consciousness vanishes. And then you're left with nothing. Nothing is left. And then even nothing has to disappear. You know, neither perceiving nor non-perceiving. Perception is disappearing. And then perception stops. Nothing, not even nothing is left. Everything is gone. That's weird. And the reason it's weird is because the last vestige of who you think you are, the knower, that you are the one behind these eyes watching me, that you are the one between these ears listening to me, that you are at the control panel of your body and mind, logging in, logging off. After a while you find even that is a total delusion. That you vanish as well, and there's nothing left. Oh, what bliss to be finished at last. If there's anything left, you will always suffer. When everything's gone, only then is suffering completely, once and for all, ended. Do you want to go? No, you don't. We want to get enlightened and enjoy it. We put all this money and time. We want to go to the heaven called Parinibbana and listen to our favourite Jimi Hendrix records, have sex all day, be young and pretty again, and have no pain. That's what you really want. But anyway, this is what happens. And so that happens in these deep meditations. They would happen to you eventually anyway. You've got no choice. Now you've got these messages there. So when it happens, remember the simile of the still forest pool. Don't get excited. Don't get afraid. Just sit there and be still. When things start to disappear, that's what's supposed to happen. Go along for the ride. It's the most happy, blissful, peaceful, meaningful experience you could ever have. And that's where you hear the Dhamma. Not from monks like me. You hear the Dhamma in the silent stillness of a deeply concentrated mind, in the jhanas. Not words, but the experience of freedom, the taste of freedom, the bliss of release. There, that's what's for you if you stop. Well, thanks for listening. Okay, so it's easy. So I expect all of you to get enlightened by lunchtime. Okay, let's have your dreams now.